Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, a multi-generational story of growing up in turbulent times. For baby boomers, it was the assassinations of JFK, RFK, and Martin Luther King, as well as the war in Vietnam. For millennials, it's been 9/11, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and the Great Recession of 08. Now, this turbulence is the backdrop for Kurt Anderson's latest novel, True Believers. Set in the near future and the recent past, Karen Hollander is an attorney, a TV commentator, and former Justice Department official who walked away from a likely Supreme Court appointment. Today, she's trying to tell her memoirs of coming of age during the chaos of the anti-war movement of the 1960s. That decision to write the true story of her life is underpinned by a relationship with her millennial granddaughter, who becomes her confidant as she tries to tell the whole truth about tragic events long since covered up and forgotten. The name of the book is True Believers. My guest today is Kurt Anderson, the author of the novels Heyday and Turn of the Century, among other books. He writes for television, film, and the stage, contributes to Vanity Fair, and of course is the host of the public radio program Studio 360, which is heard here on Public Radio Tulsa. He's previously been a columnist for New York, The New Yorker, and Time Magazine, editor-in-chief of New York Magazine, and co-founder of Spy. He joins us today by phone here on Studio Tulsa. Kurt Anderson, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Happy to be here, Rich.
Let's talk a little bit about this novel, True Believers. I gather that you're really writing about the sort of cultural connections between the boomers just as the 60s got crazy and perhaps what's happening today with the millennials who maybe a decade ago were supposed to be the happiest generation we've ever had.
Yeah.
Remember those stories about the millennials?
Yeah,
most positive
as the father of millennials, there's some truth to that, I think.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, really, I mean, of course, it's a novel. I'm not really writing, you know, it's not an essay about that fact, although, you know, people can draw their own conclusions about what I think of baby boomers and what I think of millennials. It's really a story about some people, particularly one, the main character, who is indeed absolutely a kind of ultimate baby boomer, and her granddaughter, the millennial, is another major character. And yeah, it's about life then and life now, and the differences and similarities between them.
Do you think there are some similarities between, say, the book sort of moves in time from actually the future, about a year or two from now,
yeah,
to early 60s and through the mid 60s and finally the crazy 60s at the end of the decade?
Yeah.
Do you see some connections between what we've been going through the last few years and what was happening in the early 60s, you know, with the Kennedy assassination and Vietnam, and all of a sudden this sort of change in feeling about power structure in America?
Well, it's a very different time, and these aren't the 60s, certainly. And I didn't really begin this novel, which is, you know, it's fiction, with an idea of here's how the 60s are like or different from the present day. But I was struck, once I started imagining myself in the 1960s and writing this story, I kept thinking of my favorite quote attributed to Mark Twain, which is that history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. And I began seeing the various rhymes, and certainly as I was just finishing the novel, having created this fictional movement of young people protesting massively, I turned in the manuscript and suddenly it had a name, and it was in real life, Occupy Wall Street. So there's some repetitions. And also, I do think that I came to think, writing this story and these characters, and really it's told by a woman looking back on her life as a teenager in the 1960s and her life since and her life today, that we think of the 60s, the late 60s, the crazy 60s, as you correctly call them, being all about, you know, sex, drugs, rock and roll, essentially, and politics and protests. I came to think that there's 60s DNA in places we'd least expect it. I actually think that the selfishness of the present day in so many ways and the kind of greed is good idea, it also has its roots in the 1960s. So it was one of those crazy historical inflection points that come once or twice a century, and I think we're still living off the effects.
Where are those roots in your mind?
Well, I think that once this sort of hyper-individualism that sort of flowered like crazy in the 1960s, you know, follow your own truth, do your own thing, all those things, on the one hand, they led to, you know, grown-ups behaving like teenagers and listening to rock and roll music and wearing blue jeans for the rest of their lives into their 60s, 70s, and to the end, and every generation thereafter doing the same. So all that stuff. But I also think, a flip side of do your own thing is I've got mine, Jack. You know, you remove the community and communitarian aspects from all that 60s do your own thing, you know, stuff. And it seems to me you've got, you know, hedge fund managers, basically. So I think, you know, it's not as simple as it's often depicted.
Where was the beginning of this novel? I would like to talk about Karen Hollander, the character that narrates the book. You know, the typical 60s arc, a very somewhat geeky middle schooler.
Totally
becomes politically active, goes to college, has a great career. She's a lawyer. She's a DA. She's up for the Supreme Court when all of a sudden she pulls back and she says, I'm going to academia. I'm withdrawing from this sort of high-powered life. And now she's worried about Alzheimer's. She has diabetes. She's constantly checking her blood. And now she's says, I'm going to write the true story. And this is what the book is about, a secret that unfolds in the pages as she's remembering her life.
That's right. And it really is her story, but it's her secret is spectacular, which is why she spends the course of this memoir, which is her fictional memoir, telling it. But, you know, I think, again, a lot of people in general, a lot of people of her generation, have this sense that they got away with murder, figuratively speaking, when they were young. And I think this sense also that, again, I think it typifies that generation of having your cake and eating it too. You know, yeah, I'm a bohemian, but I also have this fancy, lucrative career. So in a lot of ways, as it turns out, she's an extreme example of her generation and generations that followed her.
Let me ask you, do you think that today's youths growing up don't have that same sort of sense of entitlement or that the boomers did that, you know, we can protest, we can rebel, and then all of a sudden we're going to grow up and make our living just like our parents did before us, maybe even better?
Sure. Well, I think it's different. I think, first of all, the boomers, as young people, as teenagers and young adults, had this sense of, you know, world historical self-righteousness. We know the truth. We see clearly. We know who's bad and who's good. And, of course, that's, you know, every adolescent always.
Yeah, that's a function of youth.
That view of things. But in the late 60s, the whole world sort of said, yeah, you do. You are. You're special. So, sure, you know, young people today have certain senses of entitlement, but they didn't go through that kind of crucible or that late 60s moment where the whole world is telling every 18-year-old that he or she is, you know, a new species of human being.
Talk about writing about the 60s. What was interesting to me is, you know, I grew up just after the James Bond thing hit, and you know, there's a big story about how these kids just really idolized Ian Fleming novels, and mm-hmm. when the movies came out, and it kind of reminded me a lot of what millennials have done with Harry Potter.
Yeah.
You know, it's that same sort of thing that you're writing, they're doing it about James Bond.
That's true, and the 17-year-old granddaughter, when her grandmother tells her how she, what this James Bond sort of obsession and play acting she did when she was young, sort of says something similar. I do think, I mean, again, I didn't begin with this idea, but once I wrote this particular story and thought about where we are today and the Harry Potter obsession and online games and avatars and all the rest, that there has been, in the last half century, just a lot of people who plunge deeper than people have, I think, almost ever, into these sort of fictional worlds. And we all do in our own way. And whether it's in the case of my character, Karen Hollander, who always, in the back of her mind as she's going through foreign airports, sort of hears the James Bond theme song in her head, to my children who don't go a week without comparing some incident in real life to something that happened on the TV show Friends. You know, so, I think the fiction, whether it's movies or novels or TV, has become a kind of template for how a lot of us see our lives, and it's hard to separate one from the other.
My guest today is Kurt Anderson, a writer. His latest novel is titled True Believers. He's, of course, the host of Studio 360, heard on Public Radio 89.5. And he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Well, I assume you've written female characters like this. Have you ever written a character like this as a narrator before? Really telling the story?
I have not. I have written important major female characters, and I've written short stories, short fiction in the first person. This is the first time I wrote a novel in the first person, with, as you say, as the narrator telling the whole story, and which raised the bar for being persuasive, because of course, unless I didn't choose to use a female pseudonym, so everybody knew this is a man writing in a female voice. But the job of a fiction writer is to imagine the inner lives and the voices of people unlike him or her, whether they're different nationalities, different social backgrounds, different races, different genders. So it's one more of those. But yes, at least half the readers will wonder, well, I'm a woman. Let me see how if I find this convincing. And so far, I've been very gratified to hear that they have.
I mentioned earlier the big section on Ian Fleming and James Bond. One of the things I wanted to ask was how Studio 360, and you know, you're constantly looking at new trends in culture.
Uh-huh.
How that informs your writing? I would think it would be sort of a fertile sort of sounding board for totally. Ideas for writing.
Absolutely, I think there's a two-way fertilization that goes on. That as I'm writing stories or pieces, I develop little ideas that we pursue on Studio 360, and vice versa. When I get to talk to great writers, great filmmakers, great musicians, learn stuff about what they're doing that either deepens my knowledge of something, or especially in the case of music, where I'm an old fogey out of touch with what the young people are doing today. I learn stuff every week that then often provides seeds for my writing. There's a great kind of a give and take between my essentially what is my morning job as a writer and my afternoon job as a radio host.
My guest today is Kurt Anderson, writer and host of Studio 360. His latest novel is titled True Believers. It tells the story of Karen Hollander, who is writing her own story. Now, you set this a couple of years in the future, or maybe a year or so in the future.
Yeah.
That was an interesting sort of place to put the novel. Why did you want to set it in the future?
Well,
but not that far in the future.
Yeah, and as people continue reading this a year and a half from now, it won't be the future. I did that with my first novel as well. It for me, and I think for, again, the readers who read it when it's first published, it allows for a certain kind of imaginative twist of real life. That this is this is essentially a realistic novel about life today. But when I invent TV shows that don't exist, or pharmaceuticals that don't exist, or various things that don't exist, often for humorous intent, and put them in this real world, if I say it's in 2014. It to me anyway, and I think to some readers, it makes it seem like, well, this could be in 2014. Maybe this drug that enhances spiritual well-being really will exist in 2014. So that's one of the reasons. It could just as easily be set today or 2 years ago. Again, one of the reasons I did it was I wanted the 50th anniversary of John F. Kennedy's assassination to have already taken place. So there are small little narrative reasons also that I said in the future.
Yeah, and that's a very small but important point in the book, because that was the moment when all of a sudden all the fun about the early 60s began to change.
Yeah.
For white suburban kids, which is this is what this is about.
yep, it is.
So getting back to the book for a moment, Karen Hollander decides to write her memoir. And this is where the secret comes out. She, at the end of the 60s, she's very politically active. And as the book unfolds, we don't know exactly what that is, but we know something really bad has happened.
Mm-hmm.
And the decision to write about that, this is what the novel is about. And also, you're bringing in a lot of evidence today that we now know about the 60s, like how all of these protest groups that she becomes a part of were infiltrated all over the place by federal agents who were sometimes the instigators.
Yes, exactly. No, I was just a few weeks ago, a guy who was considered one of the major sort of left-wing heroes in the San Francisco Bay Area, part of the protests, died and was revealed to have been a lifelong FBI informer. So absolutely. And that's the other reason, as you know, it flips back and forth between being set in the 60s and then being set now in the near future and looking back. And as Karen looks back, she tries to sort of correct for some of the misinformation and the misunderstandings that became established at the time about why certain riots started, or the background of the famous killing by the Vietnamese general of the Viet Cong suspect on the street, and all these things that become part of a story, but you know, in the fullness of time, some years later, you can look back and say, well, no, that wasn't exactly how it went down, and just the uncertainty of understanding and the uncertainty of what, you know, somebody believes is the truth is nobody has the full truth, and truth is fragmentary, and that's what she discovers when she tries to write her story, that she discovers all kinds of things. You know, she knows some things she didn't know, but then there are lots of things she didn't know that she discovers she didn't know and were not what she thought they were. So that's part of the journey of this story.
So maybe Donald Rumsfeld was right. There are unknown known.
Donald Rumsfeld was right about that, for sure.
Well, one of the things that's interesting is the idea that a person who was, you know, in consideration for the Supreme Court would actually decide to scrub all the bio editing that probably went on in her life, which, you know, all people have to a degree some sort of bio editing, biography editing.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty amazing decision and an amazing premise in this day and age where, you know, as soon as somebody has power and writes a memoir, it's all about justifying what they did, okay, well, here's the real truth.
Yeah. Well, no, and in that sense, this would be extraordinary if somebody in her position did such a thing. And she understands, as she describes, that this is going to cause a storm of controversy when it's published. But it's kind of the memoir, at least, that I wish these people who had led lives like this would write, instead of the essentially, as you say, self-justifying, sanitized versions we get. And occasionally they come along. I mean, I was, you know, Catherine Graham, the publisher of the Washington Post, published an extraordinarily good and frank and intimate memoir. You know, she didn't reveal, criminal past or anything, but it was, so occasionally people do it at when they reach a certain age and decide, you know, I'm going to tell the truth rather than, I'm not in line to, I'm not trying to get somewhere more, and I think I've had as Karen Hollander does in True Believers, I think I've had a decent life, but I made this terrible mistake when I was young, and here's the whole story.
Yeah, and there's some interesting twists and turns along that, and with her other friends who were part of this movement, how they react to it. One reacts very badly. One is in just absolute, I don't know what you're talking about. he's absolutely edited out of his life. These
well,
incidents.
He's edited out of his life, and he was playing games then, and he's still playing games now. And there are of her friends who were involved. There are two of them that she sort of against her inclinations tells what she's doing, and yeah, as you say, they react very differently, and in one case, or in both cases, do their best to sort of either change the subject or escape blame.
What do you think keeping a secret does to a person? I mean, this is part of the idea of this book and this character that, you know, she made many decisions based on the fact that she had this secret.
Yep. Yeah, well, I think that's one. I mean, and again, this is a spectacular secret, and she's this public figure with a spectacular secret. But I, you know, millions of us have various secrets we keep, and I think the bigger those secrets are, and the more they do drive the choices we make in life and the way we interact with people, the you pay a price. You just do. The more straightforward one can be about who one is and what one's done, I think the happier one is in life, and the more you're not always thinking, oh gosh, I can't say that, or I can't talk about that. And in her case, it just, even though she's led this, by all appearances, responsible, successful life, she never stops thinking that nobody knows who I really am. I am, in this critical way, not who everybody thinks I am. And that became just, she didn't want to, you know, keep bearing that burden. And her Catholic girlhood, which she's abandoned the church since she was young, she realizes once a Catholic, always a Catholic, and to some degree this is her final confession.
My guest today is the author of the new novel True Believers, Kurt Anderson, who is also the author of Heyday, Turn of the Century. He is the host of Public Radio's Studio 360, and he's joining us today on the program. And if we can talk about Studio 360, this has been a great job. The one thing I'm amazed about is how you find what a lot of times these are absolutely unknown artists, writers, filmmakers, or musicians to the nation as a whole, and you find these people, and almost inevitably they turn out to be some sort of trendsetter that within a few months we're starting to hear about these people.
Nice to hear. That is. I mean, that in the ideal case, that is what we try to do, and that does
Work out that way.
We also have people like Matt Damon and who everybody's who are big.
Yeah, I think he's got a good future.
I think he's got a future in the business. But we really try to mix it up, and really are as with any program, magazine. We're looking at the whole culture, high, low, in between, everywhere, everything, and just trying to find people who are doing something that we find excellent and interesting. Sometimes they're well known, sometimes they're not at all well known. But as you say, we're very gratified when somebody we put on is suddenly, the rest of the world catches up.
Is there any difference between, as you're looking at like an emerging group or an emerging filmmaker, whether it's faddish or they're actually maybe trendsetting or going to make a statement in the culture? Is that something you look at when you're trying to put together shows and put together, introduce people to really the country at large?
Well, the bar is, no question, the bar is higher for somebody who is just barely emerging, who doesn't have a name and isn't recognized. I mean, I don't think we consciously say, does this person have a big future? Are they going to be famous in a few years? But certainly, their work, whether it's a movie or a piece of a novel or a record album or whatever, it needs to be great. I mean, we really are. We're this is an age where the gatekeepers are supposedly disappearing, but we sort of regard ourselves as keeping our little gate. And if somebody, but if somebody is doing great stuff and it crosses our, comes into our consciousness, we couldn't be more excited about giving them talking to them, letting them play, introducing them to our audience. But it's really about, is this something we haven't heard? Is this great? More than will the world soon remember and acknowledge that this person is great? It's really just, you know, case by case saying, wow, I've never seen anything like this before. Let's put her on.
You know, it's interesting. Your job is very difficult because I could see keeping up with new trends, especially as one ages and, you know, you're in your 50s or you could keep up with maybe the trends in writing. And maybe trends in film, for that matter. But there's, you know, or vice versa, you might not be able to keep up with the trends in music. Music, you know, it's all in the ear and the eye and the vision of the beholder. How do you find yourself, you know, hearing a band and people saying this is the new thing, and you're going, well, it doesn't ring a bell with me.
Yeah, it's a good question, and well, partly I have a staff of
probably young people.
People who are the oldest one is, I think, 15 years younger than I am. So that helps. I have two daughters in their early 20s. That has helped over the last 10 years as they've gone from being 12 to 22. And in general, I mean, I shouldn't be in this job if I didn't have, an open
curiosity.
Mind, an open heart, open eyes, open ears. And even, I'll tell you, even if when I don't like something, when I wouldn't be a buyer of a thing or a viewer of a thing, if the person is interesting and if people whom I trust say, this is great, this is, you know, this record or this DJ or whatever is great, I'll trust them and then find out, is it just my ignorance that doesn't allow me to be a fan? And often that's the case.
Yeah. No, there's no doubt. Anybody who can talk about their work in a way that connects with you, even if maybe the work doesn't, then there's something substantive to it.
Well, that's the thing, and that's a lot of the people who we hear from who listen to the show say, you know, once a week there is a movie I want to go see as a result, or a book I want to read, or a record I want to buy, but the rest is really just keeping them informed and aware about what's going on in the culture, just so they don't, you know, sink into their own little silo where they know what they know and don't get, you know, new information, where there's not new blood flowing through their cultural bloodstream. And so, yeah, it's not just a show, Studio 360, to say what book should you buy next or what movie you should see next. It's also, I want to keep up with where the culture is going in all kinds of ways.
Wow. Well, I would imagine as we mentioned earlier, it probably has a great effect on your writing. Just talking to all these artists in a variety of fields, emerging art fields, as well as the ones we all think of traditionally. That's the one thing I appreciate about the show. Well, the name of the novel is True Believers. It's a really wonderful read. Kurt Anderson, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. It was my pleasure.
Kurt Anderson is a writer and the host of PRI's Studio 360, heard here on KWGS, and the author of True Believers, his latest novel. It's published by Random House. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.